Today, the United States Supreme Court announced its final decision for the season, striking down Washington, D.C.'s ban on handguns and declaring an individual's right to own a gun. We'll discuss the ruling, what it means, who it affects, and what it says about the composition of the High Court. This is Jerry Johnson live from Criswell College. Join us as we look at today's news from the Christian worldview for Christ and culture.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
I have a dream.
It depends upon what the meaning of the word is.
Yes. And the people who knock these buildings down will hear all of us soon.
We will not tire, we will not falter, and we will not fail.
Welcome to Jerry Johnson Live. For the next hour, this is your place for relevant discussion of topics in the news and in our culture from a Christian perspective. Later in the show, we'll open the toll-free lines for your questions and comments. You may also email us at talk@jerryjohnsonlive.com. Now, here is Penna Dexter.
I have only five words for you.
From my cold, dead hands.
Charlton Heston would have been happy today. He was the president of the NRA, the National Rifle Association, for 5 years. That is a clip from his speech at the 2000 NRA convention. He raised a replica of a Revolutionary War musket over his head and declared his Second Amendment rights would never be taken away from him. He would have been happy because for the first time in history today, the Supreme Court ruled that Americans have the right to own guns for personal use. This is a landmark decision, and here's a report.
The Supreme Court says Americans do have the right to own guns for self-defense and hunting. It's a 5-4 vote of the justices' first major ruling on gun rights in U.S. history. It strikes down the District of Columbia's 32-year-old ban on handguns, saying it's incompatible with gun rights under the Second Amendment. The decision goes farther than even the Bush administration wanted, but probably leaves most firearms law intact. The court had not definitively interpreted the Second Amendment since its ratification way back in 1791. John Belmont, Washington.
Now, there's been a thorny issue regarding gun rights. The key issue really behind this decision, John Belmont explains it.
The basic issue for the justices was whether the Second Amendment protects an individual's right to own guns no matter what, or whether that right is somehow tied to service in a state militia.
All right, this case was called Washington, D.C. versus Heller, Dick Heller, the armed security guard who sued the District of Columbia after it rejected his application to keep a handgun at his home for protection. He says now he's very happy with the ruling.
I'm very pleased to have been able to take this case with help from my attorneys all the way to the highest court in the land. And I'm very happy that now I'm able to defend myself and my household in my own home.
Later in the program, John Lott will join us. He's got the stats on guns and crime. His books are The Bias Against Guns and also More Guns, Less Crime. And he's got to be very happy about this decision. And then also, what does this ruling say about the court? It was a 5-4 split with Justice Kennedy, the swing vote as he often is. Aaron Street will join us. He's the son of one of our professors here at the Criswell College, Dr. Alan Street. And Aaron is an attorney. But after law school, he clerked for then-Supreme Court Justice Rehnquist. So we're going to discuss this ruling, whether that court would have ruled this way back then, and how it's really a big deal, and really how long it took to get this ruling on gun rights, all of those issues later in the program. But right now, we're just going to talk about what it really said. And with us to do that is Dave Workman. He is senior editor of Gun Week, which is a publication of the Citizens Committee on the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Well, it's very kind of you to have me. Gun Week is actually owned by the Second Amendment Foundation, and the Citizens Committee is kind of a sister organization.
Okay, the Second Amendment Foundation, and that's what this case was all about. Can you tell us really what the case did and what it didn't do?
Well, the ruling, as everybody knows now, struck down the District of Columbia's handgun ban, which the justices said, in effect, a gun ban does not stand constitutional muster. More importantly than that, the ruling said that the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms is a right of all the people, not just people who are involved in the militia or the National Guard or some quasi-military organization. That everybody, every citizen in this country has a right to keep and bear arms. And that certainly pulls the plank or the central plank of the foundation right out from under the gun control movement, because they have held for years, ever since the 1939 Miller ruling, that the Second Amendment only applied to service in some kind of a militia.
It's been 70 years since the High Court addressed whether the Second Amendment protects this individual right, and this is just a key ruling. And Mr. Workman, Scalia wrote the opinion, and he was very clear on this. This is about handguns, and it's about defending yourself in your home, right?
Yeah, but the opinion goes beyond just the ownership of handguns. It also touches on whether or not there might be a future case regarding the ownership of so-called assault rifles, which are, you know, semi-automatic firearms that look like military rifles, simply because those would be the guns that somebody might be expected to provide and show up with if the citizen militia is ever called into service. So there's a lot of meat in this ruling that I've spent most of the day trying to read through the thing and answer phone calls, but I think it goes way beyond what even some of the gun rights people expected, and it's going to take some time to really flesh it out.
Well, I know that it went beyond what the Bush administration expected, and I think we have a clip that basically addresses that, Larry. It's number 8, cut number 8. But, you know, the Bush administration weighed in for the ruling that came down today, but not quite to the point that it was actually ruled. And I think Dick Cheney sort of broke away, and he has got to be very happy with this ruling. Let's hear that cut.
Bush is in strong agreement with the Supreme Court majority, according to a statement from the White House. The statement says the individual right of Americans to keep and bear arms is a long-held view of the administration's. The president is also pleased the court concluded the D.C. firearms law violated that right. Jackie Bechere, Washington.
Dave Workman is with me. He's a senior editor of Gun Week. And Dave, do you have any idea why the Bush administration didn't go full on, as Dick Cheney would, in support of this position?
No, I really don't. I know that there are probably reasons that they wanted to see if the particular D.C. gun ban would be upheld. But cutting through all the various presumptions, and there's going to be a lot of theorizing over this for the next couple of weeks on talk television and talk radio.
Right.
I think it boils down to the place where the Supreme Court said, you know, this is a civil right. It's not subject to the various whims of political correctness or the issue du jour of some politician. It's a civil right. It applies to everybody, and now we have a chance to move on. I know I've talked to some people today who believe that this is going to be the building block, the foundation for maybe future challenges to other gun laws around the country.
Other restrictions.
Yeah, other restrictive gun laws. It might be also used as a launching pad for people to work through their state legislatures to change some of these onerous gun laws. And we'll just see how that works out here in the next few months.
All right. In a minute, I want to ask you another political question. But first, folks, give us a call, 800-881-9270. I want to know what you think about this ruling. Good idea, bad idea. Are you happy that the Supreme Court has actually upheld the right to own a handgun in your home, an individual right to keep and bear arms? My guest is Dave Workman from Gun Week. Dave, Barack Obama has been criticized today by John McCain because in Chicago there are some pretty tough gun laws. And so McCain is definitely making this a political issue. Do you think that will continue?
Yeah, I do. And I think McCain is probably right to do that. Obama has told a newspaper in Pittsburgh here a few months ago that he's against concealed carry, doesn't support the idea. There are millions of law-abiding citizens around the country who are licensed to carry concealed. You know, that was kind of an affront to all of those people when Obama just dismissed their right of self-defense. McCain, I think, has got a solid issue that's going to have some legs to it, because here we've got a landmark ruling. It probably is the most historic ruling that you and I are ever going to see in our lifetime on a fundamental individual civil right. And it lands right in the middle of the 2008 presidential campaign. You bet this is going to become a political issue, not just for McCain v. Obama. It's going to be an issue with people running for Congress, for state legislative offices, probably even down to the office of mayor and city council in some of these communities.
Dave Workman, thank you so much for joining us today and giving us your thoughts on this issue. We appreciate that and also the work that you do.
Well, it's very kind of you to have me, I tell you, this is a story that's going to keep me busy for a long time.
Well, it sure is, and we may get back to you as we unpack this.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you very much. You know, you've got to remember that Barack Obama made a statement that is going to come back to haunt him, talking about the residents of struggling small towns. This is before the Pennsylvania primary, saying they get bitter and they cling to their guns and their religion. I think that soundbite will be played here and there, don't you? Well, let's go to the phone. Frank is in Little Elm. Frank, thanks for calling in.
Hi, Penna. Thanks. I'm actually just elated over the decision. I think it's a long time coming. And the other gentleman made a good point, his last point on Barack Obama. I think the most critical aspect of this year's election is not necessarily the issues, but the fact that we have justices that could very well retire. So whoever does probably win the election, and in this case I'm certainly hopeful that someone that will appoint justices that will be strict constructionists, that will not be activist judges. And in this case, I think the court made the right decision. And I think that is the most compelling issue in the election this year. It's not necessarily all of the other issues.
Not just guns, but also judges. A very important issue. We're going to devote much of the third segment to that. And then, Frank, thank you so much for calling.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, as we said earlier, this case had a lot to do with the question of whether the Second Amendment refers to militias or to individuals' rights to keep and bear arms. So let's just go to the opening argument before the Supreme Court in this Heller case. The attorney for D.C., Walter Dellinger, is arguing, and then you'll hear Justice Roberts coming in. Let's hear it.
Even if the language of keeping and bearing arms were ambiguous, the amendment's first clause confirms that the right is militia-related. It's essential meaning.
If you're right, Mr. Dellinger, it's certainly an odd way in the Second Amendment to phrase the operative provision. If it is limited to state militias, why would they say the right of the people?
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to continue throughout the program to discuss this issue, and we are going to give you opportunities at various times to call in if you have an opinion on whether or not this was a good decision in your mind. How will it affect your life, for instance? We'd love to hear some of those stories. But next up, I'm very excited about our guest because, of course, this gun ban was the strictest in the nation. And Washington, D.C. is an area where there's one of the highest crime rates. So we're going to talk with someone who knows how owning guns actually affects crime. He's John Lott. He will join us. He's a researcher. And, of course, his book, More Guns, less crime sort of tells you where he's coming from. He'll join us next on Jerry Johnson Live.
I thought my life was too busy to get a master's degree, but Criswell College makes it easy. Did you know that you can now get a Master of Divinity degree in just one day a week? If I can fit this into my schedule, I know you can too. Come to Criswell College on Mondays and increase your education for more effective ministry. With concentrations in pastoral ministry, evangelism, Jewish studies, counseling, philosophy, and more, you can build your personal ministry with a master's degree or go on to get your doctorate. You'll study with some of the most distinguished professors in the nation and get plenty of hands-on experience outside the classroom. All it takes is one day a week. Come join me and my friends on the Criswell College campus and get your Master of Divinity degree. One day, one place. MDiv Monday at Criswell College. Call us at 800-899-0012 or check us out at criswell.edu. That's criswell.edu.
Invest in God's kingdom and in yourself through the Criswell College. See us on the web at criswell.edu. That's criswell.edu.
You're listening to Jerry Johnson Live. Now here's Penna Dexter.
Unfortunately and disappointedly, the Supreme Court did not uphold the three-decades-old handgun ban here in the District of Columbia.
That's Washington, D.C. Mayor Adrian Fenty. He wasn't too happy about this ruling. And, of course, it's the Supreme Court ruling handed down today. We've all been waiting. This was the final ruling by the Supreme Court in this season. They ruled that Americans have a right to own guns for self-defense in their homes. This was the justice's first major pronouncement on gun rights, really, in U.S. history. It was a 5-4 ruling, and it struck down D.C.'s 32-year-old gun ban on handguns as incompatible with gun rights under the Second Amendment. Let's go back to D.C. Mayor Adrian Fenty offering this explanation of the ruling.
The Supreme Court's ruling, again, is limited just to handguns in the home. It does not affect the legality of firearms carried outside the home.
The folks from the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, they were against this ruling. They weighed in on the other direction. Paul Helmke, a spokesman there, said, although his organization doesn't agree, they were happy to hear that the ruling includes limitations on the Second Amendment.
Justice Scalia specifically mentioned limitations on carrying concealed weapons, limits on who is able to acquire a gun, such as felons and the dangerously mentally ill, limits on where guns can be taken, such as schools and government buildings.
Again, Paul Helmke, president of the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, saying it's clear the Supreme Court determined some limitations on the Second Amendment are constitutional.
They said that you can no longer have near total prohibitions on guns, but they also said you can have reasonable restrictions on guns.
With me now is John Lott, and we love John Lott because of his book, Freedomnomics, Why the Free Market Works and Other Half-Baked Theories Don't. But he also is an expert on guns. He's a researcher, right now visiting senior research scientist at the University of Maryland. He's got books on guns, More Guns, Less Crime, and the Bias Against Guns. John Lott, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
You've got to be doing a lot of media today on this issue. You just heard those sound bites from the Brady campaign. Is he correct that this really leaves a lot of gun restrictions intact?
Well, I mean, it's open to find out where future cases go. They did mention, I guess, some cases that he said certain sensitive government buildings, you could have restrictions on people being able to carry guns, and they mentioned the possibility of some other things, but this is just the first case in what's going to be many cases, where exactly the courts are going to draw the line on what are reasonable restrictions, we still have to see. I think a lot of things are going to change as a result of this. If only the fact that the mayor of D.C. and others have been claiming that if this gets removed, this ban, there's going to be skyrocketing violent crime in D.C., and I think people are going to see that's not going to happen. Just as they were wrong that in claiming that violent crime was going to fall in D.C. in 77 when the law went into effect, I think it's going to be very educational because people are going to see that the claims of problems with law-abiding citizens being able to own guns isn't going to materialize, and I think it's going to help hurt the credibility of these gun control groups that have been pushing so hard for so long on these types of rules.
Dr. Lott, you've been studying this. You've spent lots of time, lots of energy just looking at the numbers. And, you know, we don't see the reports in the media when somebody's life is saved because they've got a gun in their home. I mean, we just don't hear about that.
Right.
But it's really the case, isn't it?
I think the media gives people a really imbalanced perspective about the costs and benefits of people owning guns. I mean, without trying hard, it's very easy to recall what you think are hundreds or thousands of media stories you've heard of over your life of bad things happening with guns. But when was the last time you watched the national evening news and heard even one story about someone using a gun to protect themselves, protect somebody else? My guess is people can't think of those types of cases, and yet they occur all the time. I mean, if you look at surveys that the Department of Justice does, for example, on crime, they'll claim that about 400, 450,000 crimes each year are committed with guns. By contrast, similar surveys indicate that people use guns defensively about 2 million times a year. So about 4 to 5 times more frequently each year, people are using guns to stop crime than they are to commit them. But if you only base your perspective on what you hear on the news in terms of the ratio of bad things to good things, people would think the ratio was dramatically in the other direction, maybe even more so. And it affects a lot of the debate about gun control because if you only know about bad things that happen with something and don't know about the benefits, of course you're going to want to have more restrictions and take it away. But one of the problems that you face with these different gun control laws is we all want to try to take guns away from criminals. The problem is who's most likely to obey them, and what you find with these rules is usually the most law-abiding citizens who are ones that obey them, and you can, if you disarm law-abiding citizens relative to criminals, you can actually have the opposite impact on crime that you'd like to have, that rather than making things safe for victims, you may unintentionally make things safe for criminals. And when people go and do things like pass bans, while they're seeing these crimes that they think they can avoid by taking away the guns, they don't see and don't think about the crimes that are no longer going to be able to be prevented because you've disarmed the law-abiding citizens.
John Lott is with me. One of the things I noticed in your books is the fact that often you don't even have to really use the gun to prevent the crime. It's just brandishing the gun or the knowledge that you have a gun or even could have a gun, right?
Right. No, that's exactly right. That criminals like to go after victims that they perceive of as being relatively easy. And the better thing for them to do if somebody's able to defend themselves is to go on and try to find some other type of victim. When I was chief economist at the United States Sentencing Commission during the late 80s, I must have read, it seemed like 1,000 court case transcripts and involving robberies and other types of crimes. The interesting thing is when you'd often have two of these criminals or more committing a crime, the government would many times get one criminal to turn and testify against the other. And the questions from the prosecutors would be very similar time after time. They said, well, why did you pick this one particular victim to go after? And they said, well, you know, we were thinking about robbing the drug dealer down the street, but he has a gun that would, you know, that'd be a tough person to attack. Or we were thinking about going after somebody else, but they look like they'd be hard to attack. And then we saw this kind of musician-type-looking person that was going across the dark alley, and we figured it was an easy prey. And how they constantly, in these discussions, try to figure out who are the easiest people for them to go and attack. And when somebody's going to be able to defend themselves, they would rather go on and try to deal with somebody else.
Well, that brings me to the female sex, because in a sense, guns are the great equalizer when it comes to being able to defend yourself.
Right. Well, women benefit much more than men do from having guns, mainly because, I mean, to put simply, that guns represent a much bigger relative change in a woman's ability to defend herself than it does for a man. We have something called the National Crime Victimization Survey, which is done by the U.S. government each year, where they survey 100 to 150,000 people, and they've been doing this for 25 years. And it's amazingly detailed data that we have there. You know, the victim, where the crime occurred, the characteristics of the criminal, whether the criminal was armed or unarmed, how the victim responded. And so we can look at attacks against women or men, the type of crime that was trying to be committed. We can see how they responded, and we can see what happened to the victim. Were they seriously injured or not? Was somebody that they were with killed or not? And what you find for both men and women, the safest course of action to have a gun, but it's particularly true for women and the elderly. There's often a myth that we hear that I think is dangerous and very misleading, that people should behave passively when they're confronted by a criminal. And there's a kernel of truth to it, but it's very misleading. The kernel of truth is if you compare passive behavior to all forms of active resistance lumped together, passive behavior is slightly safer. The problem is that you're lumping together all sorts of different things. You're lumping mm-hmm. together running away, yelling and screaming, a baseball bat, mace, a knife, a gun, a stun gun. Some of those are indeed much more dangerous than passive behavior, but some are much safer. And by lumping them together, you're obscuring those differences. So, for example, for a woman, by far the most dangerous course of action for a woman to take when she's confronted by a criminal is to use her fists. And there's a very simple reason for that, and that is you're virtually always being attacked by a male criminal. And when you have a female victim and a male criminal, there's a large strength differential that exists there on average. The second most dangerous thing for a woman to do when she's confronted by a criminal is to run away. Now, sometimes when women run away, they do so successfully. But the problem is that women tend to be significantly slower runners than men are, particularly the type of men who are likely to be of the age category that they're likely to go and commit violent crimes. And in the process of being tackled and subdued, there can be very serious injury or death that can occur for the woman. And but when you look through all these things, again, the safest course of action for women to take is to have a gun. Women who behave passively are about 2.5 times more likely to end up being seriously injured than a woman who has a gun. Men, it's not as big of a benefit. Men who behave passively are about 1.4 times more likely to end up being seriously injured than a man who has a gun. And that's simply because of what I was arguing before, that there isn't the same,
the differential.
A gun doesn't make as big of a difference right. for a man defending himself against another man as it does for a woman.
John Lott, thank you so much for joining us. The books are More Guns, Less Crime, The Bias Against Guns. Thanks for being with us. Have a great day.
Thanks very much.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, next up, another issue that is brought to light today is the composition of the courts. We're going to talk about it with the son of a Criswell professor right after this.
You're listening to Jerry Johnson Live. Now here's Penna Dexter.
I'm very pleased to have been able to take this case with help from my attorneys all the way to the highest court in the land. And I'm very happy that now I'm able to defend myself and my household in my own home.
Lots of Americans are happy that Dick Heller, this armed security guard in the District of Columbia, took this case all the way to the Supreme Court. And today, of course, the ruling came down, a 5-4 decision declaring it unconstitutional to ban gun ownership, really making such laws illegal. It really has to do with owning a handgun, defending yourself in your home. But it also concerns whether the Second Amendment protects an individual right to own a gun or whether it just should be interpreted to giving rights related to service or state militias. With us to discuss some of the other ramifications of this is Aaron Street. He is actually the son of a Criswell professor, Dr. Alan Street, and he graduated. Too bad Dr. Street has such smart sons, but he graduated with high honors from the University of Texas Law School. He now works for Baker Botts in Houston, but after graduation, Aaron Street actually clerked for then Chief Justice Rehnquist. And Aaron, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure.
Are you happy about this decision?
I am very happy about it, no doubt.
A lot of Texans are really happy about it, just because we understand the importance of gun ownership here in the state of Texas. But Aaron, would the Rehnquist Court, when you were clerking there, would they have made this same decision, do you think?
Well, that is an excellent question. I was thinking about that myself today, and nobody knows what Justice O'Connor would have done with this case.
It's kind of like Justice Kennedy. I mean, to me, it's very precarious to think that he was the swing vote, and you never know what he's going to do. So we're still sort of a precarious court, aren't we?
We certainly are. And one, if there's anything you can use to predict Justice Kennedy's vote, which is always a hazardous proposition, but it's that he tends to vote in favor of individual rights or what he believes are individual rights. And that's sometimes how you can line up his votes, like in favor of the criminal defendant in the death penalty case yesterday, his vote in favor of the right to engage in sodomy in Lawrence v. Mm-hmm. Texas, and the same thing goes for today's decision, the right to bear arms. If anything can be called a right, he tends to be in favor of it.
All right, you've given us a good grid with which to predict some of these court decisions. Were you predicting this one?
I was. I will say a little bit immodestly, but I did think this would come out this way. The only question was, to me, whether Justice Scalia, everybody thought by about a week ago that Justice Scalia would be writing it just based on who had written earlier decisions this term. And the only question was whether Justice Scalia would be able to get 5 votes for his opinion or whether he'd be able to get only 4, and then Justice Kennedy would write an opinion that would narrow the impact of Justice Scalia's opinion. And fortunately, all 5 justices, a majority, signed on to Justice Scalia's excellent opinion, and so that's the law of the land.
Why do you think it's taken so long for such a case to get to the Supreme Court?
Well, I think a few reasons. One is that a lot of this historical scholarship that shows that the Second Amendment protects an individual right as opposed to just a right to bear arms in a militia has come out in the last 20 or 30 years, and you've seen the scholastic consensus or the academic consensus shift to now where the majority of historians would say it protects an individual right, whereas 30 or 40 years ago it would have been the other way. And so I think groups like the NRA and other groups that would have wanted to bring a case establishing an individual right were hesitant to do so when that was a historical consensus. And also just the fact that the courts have not been as favorable to what you might call politically conservative rights like the Second Amendment in the past as they're probably perceived to be now with Justice Alito and Chief Justice Roberts on the bench.
My guest is Aaron Street. He's an attorney, and he did clerk for former Chief Justice Rehnquist. And so I think he's got some experience to sort of handicap or analyze this court. And Aaron, you know, you talked about the key argument here, individual versus militia. And I want to take you to an opening argument before the Supreme Court in this case, where attorney Walter Dellinger, of course, representing the District of Columbia, arguing that the Second Amendment only gave the right to keep and bear arms to state militias, not to individuals. And you'll also hear Chief Justice Roberts challenging this. Let's go to that.
Even if the language of keeping and bearing arms were ambiguous, the amendment's first clause confirms that the right is militia-related. It's essential
If you're right, Mr. Dellinger, it's certainly an odd way in the Second Amendment to phrase the operative provision. If it is limited to state militias, why would they say the right of the people? In other words, why wouldn't they say state militias have the right to keep arms?
Mr. Chief Justice, I believe that the phrase the people and the phrase the militia were really in sync with each other. You will see references in the debates. The Federalist Farmer uses the phrase, the people are the militia, the militia are the people.
If that's right, doesn't that cut against you? If the militia included all the people, doesn't the preamble that you rely on not really restrict the right much at all? It includes all the people.
This is how the Second Amendment reads, ladies and gentlemen. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Aaron Street is with me. And Aaron, as you listen to that argument, I guess the court came down on the idea that this amendment relates to a militia and the people, and those are not one and the same.
Well, I think that the court pretty much agreed with what Chief Justice Roberts was saying in the argument a few months ago, and that is to say that the reason the amendment was adopted was because the founders were worried about a standing army, and they wanted to have citizens able to be armed to defend the state and to be able to defend the country. But that was just the reason the amendment was adopted. The right that the amendment's language protects, the right to keep and bear arms, is a lot broader than just the reason that it was adopted. And a couple points that that Justice Scalia made and also Chief Justice Roberts made in the argument. One is that the amendment refers to the right of, quote, the people, unquote. And whenever the Constitution uses the people in the terms of a right, it's always an individual right, the right of the people to be secure from unreasonable searches and seizures was one of the examples. That's an individual right, the right of the people to petition for redress of grievances, things like that. It never talks about that in terms of a collective right as it would be in a militia. And the second point I think that the court made today was that when the framers enacted the Second Amendment, they were writing down a right that they believed already existed before the Constitution. It was a right that existed all the way back under the English Bill of Rights, and that was a broad right to bear arms for self-defense, to take care of your family, basically to bear arms for any lawful purpose. And so the reason they put it in the Second Amendment happened to be they needed to have a strong militia, but the way they accomplished that purpose was recognizing this broad right, and I think that's how the court got to that conclusion.
Aaron, when I look at this and I see that we've had two justices added to the court under President Bush, Justice Roberts and Justice Alito, and of course Justice Roberts is Chief Justice, and looking ahead and down the road, this next election is pretty important, isn't it?
It is, and this is one of those cases that really, really points that up. And, you know, from a conservative perspective, certainly the Supreme Court appointments of President Bush have to be viewed as one of his greatest accomplishments of his presidency, and you know, it really shows that no matter how much you may agree or disagree with the candidate's views on other issues, the Supreme Court is really hanging in the balance on this next election, particularly when you think that Justice Stevens, who was the lead dissenter arguing for a collective right or a militia right here, is now 89 years old. And so, you know, just by virtue of statistics, it's likely that either he or one of the other justices will step down at some point in the next 4 to 8 years, and the next president will be appointing at least one or two replacements.
At least one or two, and, you know, possibly even three or four, because you really do have an aging court, don't you?
Yes, and I think last time I checked, there were only three justices under 70. So considering the average life expectancy for Americans born around the time they were born is only about, you know, probably 75, it's, you know, it's conceivable you could have four or five in the next 8 years.
Aaron, one more quick question. We've only got a few seconds before the end of the segment, but do you foresee more gun rights cases now hitting the Supreme Court?
Absolutely. That was one interesting aspect of the decision today. Justice Scalia and the court said that certain laws are constitutional even under this individual rights interpretation, and those are laws such as laws prohibiting a felon from possessing a firearm, laws that ban possession in government buildings or schools, things like that, laws preventing the mentally ill from possessing firearms. So Justice Scalia said certain laws like that are clearly constitutional, but he left open a pretty broad spectrum of other laws up in the air. And so there's no doubt groups like the NRA and certainly criminal defendants convicted of possessing firearms, maybe like a semi-automatic weapon, that issue's not really clear under the court's opinion, as well as other restrictions. Restrictions on purchasing of, say, two guns in a month, would that be constitutional? I think that's very questionable under this opinion.
We have a lot to look forward to under this category. Aaron Street, thank you so much for joining us today and just bringing to bear some of your experience to this issue.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, next up, we'll take your calls, 800-881-9270. What do you think about the Supreme Court's decision on guns? Give us a call.
I thought my life was too busy for me to get a master's degree, but Criswell College makes it easy. Did you know that you can now get a Master of Divinity degree in just one day a week? If I can fit this into my schedule, I know you can too. Come to Criswell College on Mondays and increase your education for more effective ministry. With concentrations in pastoral ministry, evangelism, Jewish studies, counseling, philosophy, and more, you can build your personal ministry with a master's degree or go on to get your doctorate. You'll study with some of the most distinguished professors in the nation and get plenty of hands-on experience outside the classroom. All it takes is one day a week. Come join me and my friends on the Criswell College campus and get your Master of Divinity degree. One day, one place. The new MDiv Monday program at Criswell College. Call us at 800-899-0012 or check us out at criswell.edu.
Invest in God's kingdom and in yourself through the Criswell College. See us on the web at criswell.edu. That's criswell.edu.
You're listening to Jerry Johnson Live. Now here's Penna Dexter.
Welcome back to Jerry Johnson Live. Yesterday, we had on the program Kelly Shackelford from Liberty Legal Institute, and he was also pleased with this ruling. In his press release that he issued, he said every American has the right to defend his or herself. Our founders believed that. Now even anti-gun extremists must accept the truth. And this 32-year-old gun law in Washington, D.C. has been struck down. Probably, he says, the most strict in the country. It barred most residents from owning handguns. It also required that all legal firearms be kept unloaded and either disassembled or under trigger lock. And, of course, six residents, including Mr. Heller, who we heard from earlier, filed suit. And the ruling today really protected the right of the individual to keep and bear arms. We are taking your calls on this issue at 800-881-9270. What do you think of the decision? But also, there's another story today that I want to get in before the end of the program. And it really goes to the point that was mentioned in today's Wall Street Journal in an editorial by Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice when she says, diplomacy is working on North Korea. Now, we probably have others who would disagree, but the Bush administration thinks that we're making a little bit of progress. In fact, President Bush made a statement in the Rose Garden today saying North Korea has taken some positive steps in the denuclearization process.
We welcome today's development as one step in the multi-step process laid out by the six-party talks between North Korea, China, Japan, Russia, South Korea, and the United States.
And what happened today is that North Korea handed over a long-awaited accounting of its nuclear work to Chinese officials. This was a key step in this process. It had been agreed to. It was supposed to happen at the end of last year, but better late than ever, I guess. President Bush said North Korea is keeping its word to begin denuclearizing.
Last year, North Korea pledged to disable its nuclear facilities. North Korea has begun disabling its Yongbyon nuclear facility, which was being used to produce plutonium for nuclear weapons. This work is being overseen by officials from the United States and the IAEA.
The IAEA is the International Atomic Energy Agency. And I will say that North Korea is disabling the plutonium production facility at Yongbyon. Now, before, they froze it. But this time, they're actually disabling it for the purpose of abandonment. And U.S. inspectors, and it's the old Reagan adage, trust but verify, U.S. inspectors are monitoring this on the ground. And in the declaration, North Korea stated how much plutonium it does possess. And again, we're supposed to be verifying that. And that's what has been promised here by the administration. President Bush said North Korea will take another big step tomorrow.
North Korea has said it will destroy the cooling tower at the Yongbyon reactor in front of international television cameras tomorrow.
All right. They've already done a lot to disable this, but destroying the cooling tower is sort of symbolic, and it will tell the world what it's doing. President Bush said the U.S. is rewarding North Korea's actions.
I'm issuing a proclamation that lists the provisions of the Trading with the Enemy Act with respect to North Korea. And secondly, I am notifying Congress of my intent to rescind North Korea's designation as the state sponsor of terror in 45 days.
And, but North Korea will remain one of the most heavily sanctioned nations in the world. In fact, all United Nations sanctions will remain in place. I think one of the things that this really reveals is that their economy is so bad that they need these relationships with the West. And so they're doing this. And also these six-party talks may have worked. We need to get John Bolton on because he may be skeptical of this. Well, let's go back to the gun issue. We've got calls coming in. Again, the number is 800-881-9270. If you want to weigh in on whether or not you think the Supreme Court did the right thing in striking down the D.C. gun ban, allowing people to defend themselves in their homes with handguns. Let's go to Craig in Colorado City. Craig, thanks for calling.
Hello. I am very pleased that 55% of the voting judges were able to understand the Second Amendment, and I hope that more will be able to in the future. And I hope that Washington, D.C. sees a 10% drop in crime like Texas did whenever that we were allowed to carry concealed weapons the first year.
Well, you know, it really is interesting to look at a high crime. I mean, really one of the highest crime areas in the country with one of the strongest gun bans. So I think, as John Lott said, what you're saying probably will come true. I mean, it makes common sense. But I appreciate your calling in. Have you been watching this case over the last few months?
I've been watching this type of legislation over the past 12 years. And I'm very pleased at the crime reduction that happens whenever that victims are armed instead of unable to defend themselves.
Thank you for your call, Craig. We appreciate it. Let's go back now to the arguments in this Heller case, because, as I said, Justice Scalia is the one who wrote the opinion, and Chief Justice Roberts, also Kennedy, Thomas, and Alito signed on to that opinion. The ones who dissented were Stevens and Ginsburg, Souter, and Breyer. But here is Justice Scalia during the arguments.
I don't see how there's any contradiction between reading the second clause as a personal guarantee and reading the first one as assuring the existence of a militia, not necessarily a state-managed militia, because the militia that resisted the British was not state-managed. But why isn't it perfectly plausible, indeed reasonable, to assume that since the framers knew that the way militias were destroyed by tyrants in the past was not by passing a law against militias, but by taking away the people's weapons? That was the way militias were destroyed. The two clauses go together beautifully. Since we need a militia, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
This was oral arguments that took place in March. That was Justice Scalia who wrote this opinion in the case. It was a 5-4 ruling again. It resolves a constitutional question that he was addressing there that had lurked for two centuries, whether the Second Amendment covers people who aren't affiliated with a state-run militia. And, of course, this was adopted as part of the Bill of Rights in 1791. And this is the way the Second Amendment reads, and you'll see what he was addressing there, the militia and the people. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And the Supreme Court upheld the right of the individual to keep and bear arms. And, of course, this was basically in Justice Scalia's, in his opinion, he addressed the fact that this has to do with a handgun and with the fact that you are defending yourself in your home. It's a good decision. And as our guests today on the program said, there will be more Second Amendment cases coming to the Supreme Court now that this case has been addressed. And that's why the election is so important. The court is sort of at a crossroads, and it was a very narrow decision. So we're going to have to be thinking about that, I think, ladies and gentlemen, as we look at what candidates we are going to support. One of the most lasting legacies of a president of the United States is the justices he appoints to the courts, and in specifically the Supreme Court. So it will be and is an election issue. Well, tomorrow, Dr. Barry Creamer will be with us, so we hope you'll join us then.
You've been listening to Jerry Johnson Live, a Christian Worldview radio show. Join Dr. Jerry Johnson, president of Criswell College and Criswell Communications, Monday through Friday at 5 p.m. for an hour of relevant discussion of news and culture from a Christian perspective.